Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We're going to meet a young scientist today who is on a mission. Animal behaviorist Daniel Lee is a visiting assistant professor at SIU Edwardsville. She is concerned, as many are, about the lackluster interest in the STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math disciplines in this country, and with that, with the lack of diversity in related career fields. The way, she says, to increase interest is to open the fields to greater diversity. She often lobbies for this in her blog for the Scientific American called The Urban Scientist. Danielle Lee joins me in studio. Danielle, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Why is it, Danielle, do you think, that there is so little interest in this country amongst young people about getting into these STEM fields?
Well, they are interested. What we lose is persistent professional interest in them. In other words, as they matriculate through their education, we lose them along the way. I think it's a number of factors. I think today's higher education is so expensive. Higher education has always been challenging, and now it's even more challenging because it's so expensive. So students are forced to split their commitments between, do I pay for school? Mm-hmm. Or do I focus on just school? And our higher education system was designed for individuals who had nothing else to do but focus on their studies. Mm. And most students today have jobs and have families, and it makes it hard to persist and do well. I think there's a lot of things that's preventing that. On the side of students just not being interested altogether, I think they don't know about the variety of career opportunities. I'll use myself as an example. I thought if I was had any interest in science, then I needed to be a doctor, mm-hmm. not understanding that there were a variety of career opportunities in research in particular.
What happened along the way to encourage you to switch from medicine as a potential career to what you're doing now?
I just stayed on it. So I was always interested in animals, so I was wanting to become a veterinary doctor, So still medicine. And I didn't get into vet school. What happened was I got rejected from vet school three times, soundly.
Really?
Absolutely.
And look at you now.
Yeah, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. I tell people that all the time because it helped me do what I was always interested in doing. I was always interested in animal behavior. I was always asking my teachers and professors, why are these animals doing this? Like, why? What makes them do that? And I was waiting on my teachers to give me the answers because that was my understanding of the, you know, educational transaction. I'm a student. I show up. I do the work. I learn these things. Then I'll finally be rewarded with doing that thing that I wanted to do, which was doctor on animals, because if you're interested in animals, that was the only career that I knew that existed if you were interested in animals. And in the middle of one of my rejections, I was taking graduate courses to improve my GPA, and I started doing a research project. So we encourage students throughout college to just give research a try, work with a professor, you know, work as a lab assistant. Even if you're in the lab washing dishes or assisting another professor or a graduate student in their projects, just get some hands-on experience into the scientific process, and that's what happened to me. I started doing research, studying olfactory communication in field mice, and I was bit. I mean, my first choice school called me, and they said, you need to get your final grades in. And they were familiar with me because they had rejected me so many times. And they were like, you know, we see how much you've improved. There's a really great chance you're going to get in. Just get those final transcripts in. And I pulled my application. I decided I was going to take a chance. I was like, I really found what I was meant to do, which was study animal behavior. I just didn't know I didn't know there was a career in studying animal behavior.
Well, you're a little bit different in another regard, too. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems to me that fewer women are directed toward this STEM world, if you will, than men.
Yes. There's a lot of things happening, especially, I say, along the K-12. You have amazing parents and informal educators and K-12 educators who tend to encourage girls to go the more nurturing route. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to their interest in science, so this idea of nursing or these helping behaviors, which are amazing things. I don't know if people realize it, but you can get a PhD in nursing. Like, mm-hmm. you can still do research, even in these, you know, gendered fields. But I think it's also just a lack of knowing of the opportunities. There's still this prescription that we're giving to young people, especially if they come from communities where there's not a lot of college graduates, you know, mm-hmm. in their role model pool. people that they know directly. And so you're encouraged to still going to these handful of careers where people know about, even if it's just, you know, a cursory, you know, information about those careers.
And your quest for greater diversity within these fields, gender is part of it. I mean,
absolutely.
We're talking about race and ethnicity also, well, obviously.
And ability. I mean, yeah. What it really is about is I want a science, professional science workforce, whether it's in industry or government or academia, that looks like the students in my general biology classes. You go into any general, like freshman level science course anywhere in the United States, you see a lot of beautiful faces coming from a lot of different types of communities. You take a look inside that first semester graduate school courses. Not only are these courses physically smaller, so you go from lecture halls of hundreds of students to a small seminar class of maybe 25, 30. So look at that. That's how many people we've lost from science. But then the demographics change dramatically, not just in racial components, not just in gender, but ethnicity and socioeconomic background and ability. So we lose a lot. And depending on where you come from, you have different ways of seeing the world and different ways to problem solve. And you bring something completely different to those questions that are asked. Our ability to do good basic or even applied research comes down to the types of questions that we ask. And if you, people who come from different communities, particularly if they come from communities that have been very well underrepresented in them. So working class, if you're a working class kid who goes into, you know, PhD level science, you see the world fundamentally different and you ask fundamentally different questions and you come prepared with questions usually that you're ready to answer because you saw a problem in your community. And so you're like, I came to study this to solve this problem.
You're asked to think out of the box, but you expand the box by having a greater pool of diversity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I had a friend in college who was kind of like this. He thought outside the box. And every summer he was invited to do cancer research because they said this guy thinks so much differently than everybody else that he might just be the guy to come up with, you know,
you're right,
the idea to solve a problem like cancer.
Yes, absolutely.
So what do you do and how do you attract the people that we're talking about here into these fields?
I study rodents. I study rodents across urban gradients. So I have the pleasure of studying mankind's most pernicious commensal enemy of all time. So I look at wild rodents and try to understand how is it and why is it they've just been so great at making a living around us, everywhere from the agriculture fields to urban settings. You know, what is it about different species of rodents that attracts them or disattracts them from being near us and taking advantage of us? And how do they make a living? I still do study behavior. I study animal personality, actually. I want to understand how individual differences may or may not contribute to how successful individuals are in surviving and leaving offspring. And that's it. So I try to study what I consider, even though it's basic research and it seems like really strange, there are still real life problems to be solved. You know, from an urban setting, how do we plan our cities better, our municipalities better, so that we don't have these public health potential crises? In the agriculture component, how do we plan and store our foodstuffs or our crops so that they don't contaminate our foodstuffs or compromise the economics of a farmer's season? So these are real life issues. But I do just basic science because I like to play outside. And mice and rats are relatively easy to study, not just because they're easy to get to, but they're easy infrastructurally. In other words, when I go into a community, I get strange looks because I'm out there chasing rats and mice. But once I tell them I'm studying rats and mice, I've yet to have a farmer tell me, no, you can't be on my property to catch those things.
But you might have a young man or a young woman who says, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, but I get so many more who are like, I'll give this a try. And that's what it's about.
Yeah, but back to the means of attracting people from the kinds of communities that we're talking about into these fields. How do you do that?
I make myself a lightning rod. And by that, I mean, it's like I go out there in the communities and I interact with people. Like I like to show people that I am doing science. So I pull back the veil. And so being out in the community, and when people approach me going, you're doing this strange thing, why? Just simply talking face to face with people. And a corollary of that is I use social media. Mm-hmm. And so that's really one of my main, you know, bullhorns that I use is I live stream, essentially, either live tweet or live stream, the process of science by showing people my face doing it. And then as I get students, my students doing it, showing people, you know, who's doing science in real time, and then entertaining their questions as they go, and then inviting folks to join me.
I would not be so indelicate as to ask how old you are, but you look very young. Have you seen in recent years that there has been more of a trend of people moving into these fields?
Yes. Right now, the really, really hot topic is anything like biomedical and genomics is really, really popular right now. But yes, folks are definitely moving into the sciences. Now, my field, ecology and natural history, I am on a personal mission to attract some students to kind of do these old school sciences because we still very much need folks looking at those basic questions.
I would think that someone like Neil deGrasse Tyson would be a terrific draw for young people. He is so entertaining and so informative at the same time, and he makes it interesting, not difficult to understand things.
Yes, that is definitely important, especially when you're interacting with the public. You have to just be able to explain simply, this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. And that's one of the reasons why I love working with younger folks, because they give me feedback if I'm not being clear enough. Yeah.
People, young people will do that.
Yes, they do.
We have to take a break. We're talking with Daniel Lee, a visiting assistant professor at SIU Edwardsville, but I understand that visiting is going to be removed at some point. You're going to be here more or less permanently.
That is the plan. Yes,
okay,
it is.
Well, that's very good. Great to have you in our community. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking about diversity in the science fields. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to Daniel Lee. Well, here we are. One of the stories in our headlines there concerns science studying the Zika virus, and maybe there's a cure for cancer in there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is part of your field then. I mean,
it is.
When we talk about animal behavior, we're talking about all the critters that are out there?
All the critters. Yeah. And so what I do is I study natural history, which is trying to understand wild species of animals just at their base level. So even before we do any major manipulations. And so I was actually inspired to focus on the impact of understanding natural history of the beasties that I study, rats and mice, for public health reasons. I was attending a conference where a former CDC head said the reason why we can't get on top of the thing preventing epidemiologists and doctors getting on top of major public health crises is our lack of information about bats, rats, and mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. So not knowing basic behavior, not knowing basic patterns, their ecological patterns, prevents physicians and policy planners, so science policy planners, to put solutions in place to save lives. So you can't do anything about Zika if you don't understand basic mosquito behavior and biology.
And when you think back in history to the problems that mosquitoes have created, yellow fever,
yes.
Rats, bubonic plague.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot to understand and a lot of reasons for understanding.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just understanding basic behavioral dynamics and cycling, so their population cycles, helps us make appropriate, you know, provisions for ourselves to save our lives.
In the context of our conversation here today, I have to ask, there are a lot of people who point to what's going on in Washington these days and the fact that climate change is being called a hoax and they're dismantling, in several regards, the Environmental Protection Agency. This is not a good sign for science.
It's not a good sign for science. It's complicating our ability to stay on top of the information so that we can make good informed decisions for our health and in our environment. It's also not good for us, just as everyday humans, because we put ourselves at risk when we don't have information. It's working in a black box. And now what we're doing now is dismantling the information that we had and the process for getting new and important innovative information. And so it stymies our ability to just make good decisions.
So how do people like you react to that? I mean, do you feel that there's anything you can do?
Absolutely. I mean, so science, you know, folks like to say science is apolitical, though that's a lie. Science has always been political. Having information and particularly sharing information with the masses, that has always been a political thing. That's the reason why our democracy depends on, like, good, healthy democracies depend on people being well-informed. That is political. And so science is a part of that basic information and making sure people know. What I see my role as an individual scientist and a community of engaged scientists is getting the information out there and promoting general scientific literacy. In other words, helping people feel confident and knowing when they hear something that might not sound right and getting them accustomed to knowing who the voices that they should be listening to, mm-hmm. to at least know where to find additional information.
Yeah, we call that media literacy.
Yes. And media literacy is the heart of good science literacy.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. We have some people who want to get into the conversation. I'm going to start with Ben, who's calling from St. Louis. Ben, thank you for waiting. You're on the air with Danielle Lee.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Dr. Lee. It's Ben Johnson from BioSTL. I think we had a chance about 6 or 7 years ago to work with our partner Scope before you left town. We're very excited to have you back. So we've been working for about 15 years now to grow the region's economy through our strengths in the sciences. And one of the biggest challenges there is really having a talent pipeline here in the region. And so we've launched with a series of partners a collaborative consortium called STEM-STL, the STEM ecosystem, committed to equitable access to high-quality STEM learning for all students in the region. And one of the big challenges that we see and would love your comments on how we as a region might address this is there's a myriad of great STEM, individual STEM programs, but students, particularly underserved students, often have difficulty navigating those career paths between programs in school, programs out of school, programs learning they might be doing at home. And so how do we connect those experiences so there is that persistence? And are there models that you've seen in other places in all of your experience that really do a good job of ensuring students experience when they're in elementary school is maybe linked to their experience in middle school all the way up through that persistence you described into careers?
Okay, thank you. So if I had to start, so answer it through a model question, I think one of the best models is NSBE, the National Society of Black Engineers. They have an ongoing historical out of school, so informal STEM education interaction. So it starts at elementary ages and it progresses. So it has different names as they get older. But essentially, NSBE Junior works from the elementary age up to high school and then at the college level. And it starts very broadly as just general science engagement where in the summers, so they're highly engaged in program activities, and then on weekends. And so what you have to do is have a tremendous whole concept approach, not just one thing. So you have to focus on having lots of activities. You have to focus on having an engaged, volunteer, professional class of individuals who are working with the students, and they're working as mentors. It starts off as informal education, informal science and engineering and math, but they work with these kids throughout the entire system, and it's not just showing up for the Saturday academies. It's about cultivating them as junior scholars such that they're prepared to persist in college because they become accustomed to the culture of college and science and engineering expectations. I think NSBE is one of the ones that I would definitely would credit. I would also like out of San Francisco and Atlanta, I like Science, Engineering, and Mathematics Link. That starts off as science, like they do like science and math fairs, and then they just attract big swaths of students at these tabling events, and then they start focusing on kids who keep coming to those things and their parents that keep asking questions for then assigning these kids more in-depth opportunities to work and be mentored from whatever age they arrive up into college age.
Right. We have a caller from St. Louis, Ron, who I think is going to pick up on the NSBE organization. Let's see what he has to say. Ron, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Lee. This is Ron Moore with the NSBE organization here in St. Louis.
Nice.
And I would just like to say that, you know, NSBE's on a mission to graduate 10,000 African-American engineers by the year 2025. And we're based in Ferguson at Forest and Valley Community College. And right after the Mike Brown incident, we made a commitment to increase the number of students that we were working in the St. Louis area. So we went from about 60 to 200 students in the St. Louis area that we're working with. And we've had over 200 graduates that came out of our program that have engineering degrees. Probably approximately about six of them are, have PhDs or finishing PhDs. Our biggest problem is keeping them in the St. Louis area. Out of the 200 of them, only six of them are still here in St. Louis. But most of them end up taking jobs on the east and the west coast. But we're going to still keep on plugging away. And we've also started to reach down to grade schools. We were really starting at the sixth grade level. But in Walbridge School, a city that's up on the north side, we started working with their first through third graders, and they did phenomenal. Their MAP scores went up, I believe, 20% in 1 year just after working with us with some STEM programs.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. So you point out losing students to the region. So this is, and it reminds me of the previous question that being asked about the local STEM ecosystem. I don't know the answer to this one, and I accept it as just a part of the of how STEM works. In other words, you go where the opportunities are. I'm very happy and very lucky to have been able to come back to St. Louis. I love St. Louis. It's my second hometown, but I didn't make that plan. And I would caution any student, particularly a graduate student, you know, going into a professional career in STEM, to pick a place and then hope the career works out. I always tell folks, you have to go where the jobs are. And so if you want to build a really good, viable pipeline ecosystem somewhere, then you have to have multiple industries and multiple partners at the academic, government, as well as industry level to have enough jobs to absorb that many students. And I don't know, we're a nice, great metropolitan area, but we have yet to have that area. So, yes, you're creating great seeds that get cast out in other places. But I still count that as a win because, in my opinion, the STEM ecosystem is huge. It's not just any local, hyper-local area. I do think this is a regional, if not national, thing that we should be focusing on national numbers.
Mm-hmm. I have a question here from one of our producers, Kelly, and it fits right in here, I think. She writes, we often hear in hiring that it's hard to find diverse candidates who are qualified. Is this an issue in STEM fields? Is the responsibility of the employer or the educator to fix?
Definitely the employer to fix. So I get that
they have to hire them first.
Yeah, I get that people claim that they can't find them. And yes, our numbers are relatively low, but that doesn't mean we're non-existent. There are plenty of places. What I find is that folks need to make new friends. That means get to know organizations where candidates from traditionally underrepresented groups participate. So in other words, have a membership in NSBE, have a membership in organizations like SACNAS, which is the Society for Chicano and Native American Scientists. Have memberships in these organizations that have done an amazing job. In other words, these affinity groups are a place to start, not a place to finish. And when it comes to advertising, find those places where people visit. So in other words, you know, not just the Chronicle, but look at diverse issues in higher education. In other words, they're going to have to work harder to get the word out there, to intersect eyes. We're out there. We may not be a lot, but we are definitely out there. And it's enough to at least interview. Half of your candidates should come from traditionally underrepresented.
It involves a little work, but it's there.
It's work. It's there.
Yeah. I'm going to take a quick call from Dennis in Overland. Dennis, we're very limited in time, so please make it very quick.
Okay. I've been going through some medical things, and I've been running into a lot of people that are in the medical field that are basically in their field. And listening to your guest, I'm just so excited. But I think a liberal arts education is so valuable. And I'll leave it with the old idea that curiosity killed the cat. But I think curiosity is what might save all of us cats. Yeah. And so thank you so much for what you're doing, and I love animal behavior. Take care.
Thank you. He brings up a great point. So for too long, recently, we've been pitting liberal arts against STEM. These are not dichotomous intellectual pursuits. So much of what I do depends on having a really good understanding of how the world works around me. Liberal arts do that. I would love to, I encourage my students to take all the humanities and social science courses that they can. These things are not dichotomous. You can come from a really great liberal arts foundation and still pursue the sciences. We have that much in common. It's all about curiosity.
We're going to have to end it there, but I wanted to talk to you about pouched rats. I'll just tell the audience, go online and go to YouTube and look up Danielle Lee and Pouched Rats, and you'll see a TED Talk. It's a fascinating subject area, one that you wouldn't normally ordinarily turn to, but I recommend it. Thank you so much,
Thank
Danielle
you.
Lee. Good luck to you at SIU in Edwardsville, too.
Thank you so much.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.